Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 446 for October 5th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
They came to me and said they wanted to do it, and I said, why? They said, well, we got a good bourbon, we needed a good name. So I said, okay, and that's the way it happened, as far as I know.
For several years now, I've been saying that there were only three living distillers in Kentucky with bourbons named after them. Elmer T. Lee, who passed away this summer, Parker Beam at Heaven Hill, and Jimmy Russell of Wild Turkey. Well, I've been leaving one out all these years, Baker Beam. Baker stayed out of the limelight for decades at Jim Beam, working in Booker No's shadow, but when the folks at Beam were creating the small batch collection, they asked Baker Beam if they could name a bourbon after him, and the rest is history. I'll have a rare interview with Baker Beam later on Whiskey Cast In Depth, along with the calendar of events, this week's Your Voice, and in the What I'm Tasting This Week department, my tasting notes for a monstrous whiskey. All in this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Lots of news to report this week. Let's get started. The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. What does the U.S. government shutdown have to do with whiskey? Well, more than you'd think, actually. The U.S. requires federal approval for all labels used on whiskeys, along with other spirits, wines, and beers. And even though we'd probably consider the bureaucrats who process label approvals to be absolutely essential, they're classified as non-essential and are currently on furlough while the Treasury Department's Tax and Trade Bureau is shut down. Dave Schmier of Bardstown Barrel Selections and Redemption Rye is just one of many whiskey makers caught in the red tape.
We have two new products launching in the next couple of months, we hope. On different ends of the rye spectrum, we have a brand new white Redemption Rye whiskey and a six-year-old barrel-proof Redemption Rye whiskey. Fortunately, we have label approval for the six-year-old barrel-proof rye whiskey. Unfortunately, on the white whiskey, we're still awaiting our label approval, and we've been informed by the TTB that they're not doing any label approvals while the government's in shutdown.
And you need to get that done so you can get this out in time for the holidays, right?
Yeah, but, you know, we're confident in the quality. We know we'll sell it when we bring it to market.
But it would help to have it out during gift-giving season, right?
Well, certainly, but we have other gifts that people can give.
What did you think when the TTB told you? Because I know they were racing to get a lot of stuff done before the shutdown, right?
I don't know if they were racing. You know, we kind of anticipated it. It's kind of, you know, it's frustrating, but the law is the law. Unfortunately, distillers and bottlers can't even offer to fund the TTB ourselves. You can't do that. You know, they do everything, well, they charge us a lot of taxes, but they do label approval for free. We've often thought we would be happy to pay them $100 if they expedite it, but they don't offer that, and legally they're not allowed to.
In addition, the website that distillers use to check the status of their label applications online has been taken down for the duration of the government shutdown. By the way, the shutdown also caught our buddy Benjamin Lee by surprise. As we heard a few weeks ago in episode 440, he left his job at Boston College to spend the next 2 years touring all 59 U.S. national parks by motorcycle. Ben was in Colorado when the shutdown closed down the entire national park system after just visiting 8 parks. He's detoured down to Las Vegas to wait things out for a few days. I caught up with Dave Schmier this week at Whiskey Live Boston, where Templeton Rye also made its debut in New England. The guys in Templeton, Iowa have been spreading out slowly since they launched their whiskey. Michael Kilmer is Templeton Rye's sales manager.
You know, we first met you in 06 where we had 68 barrels we sold in Iowa in about 3 months, and now Templeton Rye, we're in, upwards of 20 states and, you know, counting. We just came to the Northeast, launching Boston this month, and things are going well. And, you know, we're not going to a market until we have enough products to supply them. So things are going well, you know.
How are things going at the distillery? I know you're still not producing a lot of whiskey yet there, right?
Not a lot. No, everything's bottled there. We're still working on the production. I mean, until we can nail exactly what MPG's doing, we're not going to mess around with what's in the bottle. We've done some interesting stuff there, but nothing, you know, that's coming out, you know, nationwide. You know, Templeton's our thoroughbred, we like to say, and we're going to take it out there.
According to Michael, the stuff that's being distilled right now in Templeton will likely be sold only at the distillery's gift shop, but that's a decision that has not quite been made yet. Now, Boston is known more for its beer than its whiskey, specifically Samuel Adams beer, but the folks at Berkshire Mountain Distillers have been partnering with the Boston Beer Company, which makes Sam Adams. They're not only aging some of their Berkshire Mountain bourbon in Samuel Adams barrels, but Jennifer Sutherland told me about a project that's still a year or two away.
Our founder, Chris Well, decided that he wanted to do a cask finishing bourbon program with different craft brewers around the country. Obviously, since we're doing the whiskeys with Sam Adams, we wanted to work with them. We had a few Utopias casks lying around, so we took our bourbon and finished it for 4 months to see how the whiskey develops, what nuances it takes from the casks, and just something that was a kind of nice collaboration between the two companies. We are also, in addition with Sam Adams, we're working with Smutty Nose, Alma Gang, Victory, Full Sail, Big Sky, Cigar City, Terrapin, and I'm definitely forgetting a few of the others. But it's nice to see how whiskey develops depending on how it's aged. And it's nice to take a bourbon that is locally made in Western Mass and to see how it plays well in different parts of the country.
Now, the Sam Adams Utopia is an unusual beer. It's not that Sam Adams Boston Lager that everybody knows about. This one's matured in tawny port, rum casks, and that brings a little bit different flavor, doesn't it?
It does. So we actually last year partnered up with Sam. We bought 12,000 gallons of beer, some of their Boston Lager and some of their Senderbach. And we distilled those into two separate whiskeys. The Boston Lager whiskey is aging in some of our once-used bourbon barrels. And then the Senderbach whiskey is aging in some of the Utopia casks. So we had a few extra lying around and wanted to see before the other whiskeys that are still kind of lying and waiting, kind of wanted to see how the casks interplay. So the whiskeys that we made with Sam Adams won't be released till probably 2015, but this is something just to wet the public's whistle, in a sense, until that happens.
And you used fully hopped regular Sam Adams off the shelf or right out of the keg beer, right?
Correct.
Which is a bit unusual. Most distillers don't use a fully hopped, fully matured, full regular beer.
Very, very true. But Chris is somewhat of a mad scientist, so he likes to try new things. And the last time I tasted a sample of the lager whiskey, it's still very, very hoppy. You can taste it. You can smell it. I think it'll be nice to see how it develops and hopefully what the consumers think.
I'll have tasting notes for the Samuel Adams cask-finished bourbon on an upcoming episode of Whiskey Cast. Meanwhile, Talisker Storm made its U.S. debut Wednesday night at Whiskey Live Boston, about a year after it was introduced in Europe. In fact, its arrival was so sudden that even the brand ambassadors at the Diageo booth weren't expecting it when they arrived at the venue. It's a more intense version of the core Talisker malts and will become a permanent part of the U.S. range. Look for tasting notes soon at WhiskeyCast.com. Cavalan's Taiwanese single malts will be available in the U.S. within a month or so. King Car Distilleries has reached an agreement with Anchor Distilling of San Francisco to distribute Cavalan in the U.S. Cavalan master blender Ian Chang told me this week he'll be in the U.S. for Whiskey Fest in New York this coming week, and his whiskeys could be available in some U.S. markets during November or December. Anchor is also responsible for bringing in the first Berry Brothers and Rudd Blue Hanger expression to be available in the U.S. market. Blue Hanger is the award-winning blended malt that's been available only in Europe for the last 10 years or so. The 7th edition will only be sold in the U.S., though. Now, Ryan Maloney will be hoping to get all three of those whiskeys on his shelves at Julio's Liquors soon. His store in Westboro, Massachusetts, was the runner-up for U.S. Single Store Retailer of the Year in Whiskey Magazine's Icons of Whiskey Awards, presented last week.
I'm always honored to get recognition from my peers, and that's just fantastic on its own. But that's not really why we do what we do. We do it because of the love of whiskey. You know, we'll look back and say that we probably should have got the best of the best, because that's what we strive for, but it always gives us something to move forward and do more.
But you got the Restore of the Year last year, though.
Yeah, let's keep it going. There's nothing wrong with that. We're always trying to do our best, and that's really where it comes out of. It comes out of love for the spirit.
Now, you're getting ready for the Whiskey Weekend at the end of February, right?
We are in the planning stages and some finalization stages of that. That three-day weekend is probably going to – it's tough each year to outdo the previous year, but we're working hard to do so.
The Go Whiskey Weekend is scheduled for February 21st through the 23rd of 2014. Back in May, we heard from Barry Bernstein and Barry Steen of Ontario's Stillwaters Distillery on their initial release of Stalk and Barrel Single Malt. They've released four casks so far. Cask number five, it's on its way to the U.S., where it may arrive in time for the Whiskey Jubilee and Whiskey Fest New York at the end of this week. While I was heading to Boston after the 40 Creek Whiskey Weekend last weekend, I stopped off in Vaughan, Ontario, just north of Toronto, to check in with the guys.
Pretty good so far. I mean, there's a lot of demand for the product. People seem to enjoy it, and we've gone past cask two, cask three, cask four, and now we've just bottled cask five, and we'll be bottling cask eight this week.
And cask five is the first one that goes to the U.S. exclusively, right?
Yeah, it's a U.S. exclusive, and we're thrilled that every cask seems to be a little bit better than the last.
And a little bit different, too, right?
Right. Everything's a single cask offering, which is what we'll continue doing. We just won't have the inventory to ever do blending. So it's exciting to see what's going to come out of each cask as they come mature.
What are you learning as you open up each individual cask after it's been in wood for 3 years plus now?
Learning, it's just, first of all, what our angel share is, of course, because each cask has its own evaporation rate. But what we've done from a distillation standpoint, and then the type of cask that we're putting it into to see what the differences are. So it's, as Barry said earlier, it's just, you know, each cask seems to be a touch better than the one before, and we're really pleased with how they're maturing.
Now, Cask 5, as you mentioned, is the first one going to the United States. What's been the expectation for this cask? What have you heard so far? I know it's not down there yet since it's sitting on a pallet behind me, but what are you hoping for once this gets down to the U.S.? Because you've had some success with the first four casks in the Canadian market.
Yeah. In fact, there was some of both, of all three of casks, one, two, and three, that went down to the U.S. as well. This is the first one that's exclusively U.S. All of the previous ones were well received. I think when people taste cask five, we'll just blow them away. As good as the first three were, this one's much, much better.
And cask five is a cask strength expression at 60.3%, right?
Yes, we've bottled that at 60.3. That's what our importer wished. Purple Valley Imports wanted that, so we give him the ability to choose what he wanted it bottled at. We really like the cask strength. We'd like to stick with cask strengths as best we can. Single cask strength offerings. But the market will dictate and what we feel the whiskey will dictate.
Now, when we talked at Spirit of Toronto back in May, you guys had just started talking about distilling rye. And you'd been distilling it for a little bit, but not really saying a whole lot. And you were pouring some new make rye in Spirit of Toronto. Now you're actually tasting what the aged stuff is like. How's the experiment coming?
We couldn't be happier. We sampled the first cask back in August, and we're blown away by it. We think that people are going to be absolutely amazed, and that's the feedback from the few people that have tasted it. We're actually looking right now at increasing our rye production.
And you're actually still about at least a year and a few months away from being able to even bottle it, right?
Yeah, the first casks of rye won't be bottled until November of 2014, when it finally hits the magic three-year mark. So we're hoping to be able to release the first cask or introduce the first cask of rye at Whiskey Live Toronto 2014. So that will be our aim at any rate at this point in time.
I'll have tasting notes for Stalk and Barrel, cask number five, later in this episode. Other news from the week, Glenfiddich is coming out with a new range of no-age statement single malts for the travel retail market. The Select Cask, Reserve Cask, and Vintage Cask all use the Solera vatting process that Glenfiddich has used for years on its 15-year-old malt. The Select Cask and Reserve Cask are being rolled out now, while the Vintage Cask will be available starting next April. Jack Daniel's has had its Sinatra Select expression available in travel retail since last year, and now plans to start selling it in the U.S., along with the new Master Distillers series honoring the seven Master Distillers in Jack Daniel's history. The current Master Distiller, Jeff Arnett, says the Sinatra Select Edition uses some specially crafted barrels that are grooved inside to get more wood in contact with the whiskey. I received a sample of Sinatra Select this week. I'll have tasting notes for it soon at whiskeycast.com. And finally, Virginia has a long history of moonshiners, but the stills are usually found out in the country, not at an apartment on the University of Richmond campus. The Collegian newspaper reports a student apparently stole glass containers and rubber tubing from a university laboratory to set up a makeshift still in his campus apartment. Police originally cited the student with theft and liquor law violations. The case has now been referred to university officials for in-house discipline. It's not clear whether the student was a chemistry major, but he won't be getting any credit for his experiments. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at whiskeycast.com.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie, continuing the Caskmasters project. You've helped us choose the whiskey, and you've helped us choose the name. Next, help us choose the packaging. Sign up online at glenmorangie.com.
Congratulations to Christopher Hampton of Geneseo, Illinois, the latest winner of our monthly drawing for a print from the WhiskeyCast Photo Gallery. Christopher was selected at random from all of the registered community members at WhiskeyCast.com as September's winner. By the way, I'm extending the pledge to donate 20% from all sales in the photo gallery to the ALS Association's Parker Beams Promise of Hope Fund through the holidays. And we'll be offering free shipping worldwide on orders of $200 or more through December 15th. You'll find the gallery in the pub at WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker. Mike posted a note on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com this week. Here's what he had to say. Hi, Mark. My wife and I are somewhat new whiskey drinkers and new to your podcast, which we really enjoy. We're taking a trip to Scotland in a couple of months, probably spending most of our time in Edinburgh and Islay. We'd like to know if you have any recommendations for some single malts that we could get there that we just can't get in the States. If you've touched on this in a podcast, let me know which one. Thanks, Mike. Well, as I responded on the website, this is a question I get a lot, and it's a hard one to answer since things can change so quickly. For instance, a week or so ago, I might have suggested looking for Talisker Storm in Edinburgh, but this week we got word that it's just now arrived in the U.S. The best suggestion I can offer is to look for distillery-only expressions and single-cask bottlings, since those are the ones that are least likely to be exported to the U.S. And if you're shopping at a whiskey specialty store like Royal Mile Whiskies in Edinburgh, the staff there will probably have a pretty good idea which whiskies they have in stock that aren't exported. And if you happen to see a bottle somewhere that you've never seen before, go for it. Justin Victor has a similar question, but he's not the one doing the traveling this time. His family's visiting Australia, and he wants a recommendation on a good bottle of Australian whiskey in the $50 U.S. range for them to pick up for him. As he puts it, he would like to try something that represents Australia's contribution to world whiskey. While I've had some very nice Australian whiskeys, I don't know quite often what the prices are like down there at retail, so I'd hesitate to suggest something that might wind up being too expensive. However, I know we have plenty of WhiskeyCast community members in Australia who have a pretty good idea what to recommend. Just post your suggestions on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com, along with anything else you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, and you can also email me, too. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker, on the web at johnnywalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. First off, the Whiskey Jubilee event scheduled for this Wednesday night in Mount Kisco, New York has been canceled. The Jubilee the next night at Zanger Hall in New York City is still on, and there are still a few tickets left. If you have tickets for the Mount Kisco event, check the Whiskey Jubilee site for details on refunds. There are all sorts of tastings in the New York City area leading up to Whiskey Fest on Friday night and Saturday. Check the calendar at WhiskeyCast.com for the latest information. McTeers will hold its next whiskey auction on Wednesday in Glasgow. Bonhams will hold its next auction on Sunday the 13th in New York City. Meanwhile, the Whiskey Lounge's Manchester Whiskey Festival will be this coming Saturday in England. Aqua Vitae Essen will be this coming weekend in Mulheim, Germany. Fred Minnick will be signing his new book, Whiskey Women, and leading a discussion at the Hungry Brain in Chicago on October 16th. Sam Snead's House of Whiskey in Auckland, New Zealand, will have a Tomaten tasting that same night. Big Red Liquors will host a fine and rare bourbon dinner at Recess in Indianapolis on October 18th. A portion of the proceeds will go to the Parker Beams Promise of Hope Fund. And those are just some of the nearly 300 different whiskey events on the calendar at WhiskeyCast.com this week. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. If you missed the Laphroaig Live webcast last week, catch the replay at Laphroaig.com. And while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Billy Lighton, Master Blender, Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey.
The sherry butts in particular have a big impact on the flavour of Redbreast. It gives it the deep, dried, fruity notes, which is probably the signature of Redbreast. Take a sip, hold it in my mouth for minutes, and just dissect it and pick up all the little fruity notes. There's something that I didn't notice before. Whenever you leave your glass of Redbreast sitting there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you can go back to it and say, well, something's changed there. Why is that changing? How is it changing? Is this something that I should be picking up on, you know? It's fascinating. And, I mean, I've been in the business 34 years and it still excites me, you know, things like this.
Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know, know Redbreast.
Baker Beam is a quiet man, but very highly respected within the Kentucky bourbon fraternity. He's the namesake for Baker's Bourbon and spent most of his career working in Booker No's shadow. You'll see him occasionally at the Jim Beam American Stillhouse Visitors Center. And a couple of weeks ago during the Kentucky Bourbon Festival, we had a chance to chat during Fred No's annual barbecue in Bardstown. And with Beams all over Kentucky, it only made sense to start off this week's Whiskey Cast in depth by asking Baker just where he fits into the family tree.
My dad was Carl Beam. Carl was a nephew of Jim Beam. Carl started out at the Claremont Distillery with Jim Beam back in 1934. My dad was working in the rock quarry for Jim, and then when the prohibition was over, Jim gathered up all these people there and went down just down the block there and started the working on putting the distillery up. They used the equipment that they had at the quarry to help set the distillery up. That's why they were able to set it up in, I believe, like 120 days.
And you were 2 years old, or you were born, I'm sorry, you were born in 36, 2 years after then. Yes. So you pretty much grew up around the whole distillery in Claremont, right?
Yeah, I grew up right there in Claremont as the distillery developed.
Tell me about Colonel Beam, because as you point out, you're one of the few people still around that got to know Colonel Jim Beam.
I can't say I really got to know him. I can remember him as it seemed to me he was a towering, tall man and always in a suit of clothes and was very well thought of by the community. He helped the community and they, of course, they worked for him and he really appreciated it.
What stories can you tell about your childhood growing up around the distillery, around the Colonel, around your dad and around eventually around Booker and Fred and all those folks?
Well, I guess there's so many stories. Like you said, I was raised right there from the time I can remember anything. And to go play, well, I went to the distillery to play. And then on Saturday or Sunday, if my dad was there doing something, a lot of times I'd go with him. I was his gopher. He could send me up into the distillery to pick up a wrench or whatever, and I could like a rabbit, I could run up down the step. And that's one of the things I remember, just working with him from the very start. And then I went to work there when I got out of high school, and worked there as the first job I had was night watchman. And then later on got into the distillery, and I was there 38 years, and I retired after 38 years.
And what did you do at the distillery specifically once you finally got there off the night watchman gig?
Well, after the night watchman, I worked in the bottling house, and then from the bottling house, I went to the distillery, and I was what they call the relief man. I did all relief jobs. In other words, they was working 6 days a week, and everybody got a job a day off, so I would do their job the day they were off. And then eventually, as my dad they started the second shift, they put me on his second shift distiller. Actually, at that time, I was second shift supervisor. And when my dad left, I moved into the distiller position.
So you were essentially a distiller, and almost the master distiller, essentially, right? Or was that title even around back then?
There wasn't many titles then. Mostly it was just the work you did. And my dad, eventually they started calling him the master distiller, but really it wasn't... Really, there wasn't a title in it, was a job you did, I guess you'd say. Later on, they called me distiller, and I left there as distiller. Booker was the master distiller at that time, and I was distiller with Booker.
Tell me what it was like working with Booker. No, for those of us who never got the chance to spend any time with him.
I guess to best describe it was a lot of fun. The guy, it seemed like he always had a good day. There'd be things that would upset him, but he was always he would recognize anybody. Anybody come in wanting a job, he'd say, "Well, I don't know what I got today. Put your credentials down there, and I'll give you a call." That's the way they hired people then. And sometimes he'd hire them, sometimes they'd forget about him, I suppose. But he did everything in the distillery from all the way from the... But in the grain, handling the grain, checking the barrels, and supervising the distillery, he did it all. I mean, he knew how to do it all, because he had started out with my dad in that distillery, and they started out, I believe, in the 50s. They bought it it was real run down, and they rebuilt it and got it going.
Are you surprised by the way things have just sort of exploded up there in the last few years?
It's unbelievable to me. I remember when there was maybe one or two trucks on the property, and now you can imagine what's there now. And at one time there was, they didn't have, like I say, maybe one or two trucks to haul the barrels. They rolled them on metal pipes from one place to the other. But it's all changed now. I guess they transported all over the world.
Did you ever imagine that you'd get 100,000 people a year coming just to visit this place?
No, I never did. I remember when that was just a gravel road there. When I was a kid, it was just a gravel road. There was no interstates, so you just had two-lane roads, and that road was gravel. And trucks were so poor then that sometimes they'd have to send an additional truck over to pull the loaded truck up a hill there. You know, everything was really... more or less primitive then compared to now.
Now, your name is on a bourbon, Baker's Bourbon. How did that come about?
I tell you, I don't know. They came to me and said they wanted to do it, and I said, "Why?" They said, "Well, we got a good bourbon, we needed a good name." So I said, "Okay," and that's the way it happened as far as I know. I did mention that I'd like to see it be a good bourbon because I want to be proud of it, and we decided on the 7-year-old as my preference. The proof is strong, but it's something like Freddie says, you can water it down if you want to, but it's got a good flavor to it.
So you did get some say in it, right?
Yeah, we talked about it, but I didn't try to tell them exactly what they wanted to do, because it's a big decision there. I needed a lot of people to analyze the ideas and get it together.
Now, was this Booker's idea? Was this somebody in marketing? Who came up with the idea for it?
I think it was along with Booker's. I think it was marketing that decided to see. Booker's had already started out as the head of that, and they said, "Well, Booker sounds good and is good. Let's try some Baker's with a lesser proof and another beam and a name." They said it was a bit catchy, you know. Baker's is kind of a catchy name, I guess you might say, and Booker's and Baker's worked out pretty good.
What's your best Booker story?
Oh, there's so many stories, I don't know where I'd start. Like I said, one comes to mind, another kid, I went rabbit hunting with him. I didn't have the gun, he had the gun, and it was a rainy day, and he was hunting the rabbit, and he stepped on the rabbit. And I said, the poor rabbit, he didn't have a chance. Booker stepped on him. But that's just one little story I remember. That I was just a little boy. I was about eight, 10 years old, you know.
Did you ever get to go on the road with him when he was doing tastings and stuff?
No, I never did. No, he was, he handled that himself. I was mostly at the distillery all the time.
Now, you could have been out in the limelight, too, just as much as Freddie, your third cousin. Why did you decide to not do all that?
I don't know. I guess I'm just not that outgoing as Freddie. Freddie's got a knack for making people laugh and getting their attention, and I think he's got it much better than I have.
So of the small batch collections, or all of the Beam whiskeys over the years, is Baker's your favorite? Is that the one you prefer to drink, or is there another one?
I can't say that it's the one I drink the most. If I take a drink at night, I like the 7-year-old white label. It's a very good product, but the Baker's, I just have to cut it more, so I usually drink the white label, but I give all my friends the Baker's when they come to see me.
By the way, Baker Beam is even more closely related to Parker and Craig Beam of Heaven Hill. His father, Carl, was the brother of Parker's father, Earl Beam, which makes them first cousins. And that's this week's Whiskey Cast In Depth. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with Baker's Bourbon. Tasted this one a while back, but let's just say I verified my original tasting notes with a refresher sample or three in Bardstown. It's bottled at 53.5% ABV. The nose is dry and clean with hints of vanilla, almonds, and pears, and a subtle touch of caramel, too. The taste is spicy and warm, with notes of molasses, vanilla, and caramel, and the finish has a nice touch of vanilla, fudge, and caramel, too. It doesn't get all the attention of the small batch collection's more popular Knob Creek and Booker's bourbons, but it's an excellent whiskey nonetheless. I'm scoring Baker's Bourbon a 92. Earlier, we heard from Barry Bernstein and Barry Steen of Canada's Still Waters Distillery. Cask number 5 of their Stock and Barrel Single Malt will be available exclusively in the U.S. It's bottled at 60.3% ABV. The nose is young and malty, with straw, ginger, honey, and just a hint of oakiness. Now, the taste is, as you might expect, fiery and intense for a young malt, with black pepper and cinnamon notes that are slow to fade, but do reveal hints of lemony tartness when they do fade. The finish is long and spicy. It is young, but interesting. I'm scoring Stock and Barrel Cask number 5 an 83. And finally, I mentioned the Kubakin single malt from Tomaten a few weeks ago. The name comes from a mythical monster said, at least by the marketing department, to prowl the Scottish Highlands near the village of Tomaten. I am kidding, of course. It's a lightly peated single malt matured in a combination of virgin oak, ex-bourbon, and ex-sherry casks, bottled at 46% ABV. The nose is smoky and sweet, with notes of grilled pineapple, papaya, and mangoes, touches of brown sugar, ginger root, and a light hint of campfire smoke. The taste is sweet and spicy with grilled fruits, black pepper, a soft smokiness, and notes of vanilla and honey underneath. The finish is long and rich with a good balance, and Kubakin isn't a whiskey to fear. I'm scoring it a 90. I'm adding these tasting notes to the searchable list of more than 1,000 different whiskeys at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the calendar of events, news updates, the Your Voice page, and a whole lot more. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. You can follow me on Twitter @WhiskeyCast. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the Stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013. And for the first time in a month or so, comes to you this week from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. Had a great time on the road, but it's good to be home. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.